Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the National Press Club, the place where news happens. I'm John Donnelly. I'm a senior writer with CQ Roll Call, and I cover defense. And I'm a former Press Club board chairman, and now I'm chairman emeritus of the club's Press Freedom Committee. Thanks for joining us for this very special event. Just a couple housekeeping notes before we start. We're happy to take questions from the audience. I'll leave, 10, 15 minutes or so at the end after we have a discussion up here, or I'll try to weave in questions, I think, as we go along. But if you want to ask one, go ahead and fill out the cards and give it to Kate, and she'll pass it up to me, okay? And then the second housekeeping note is, very importantly, we have books for sale out front. So let's begin. As an angry mob of our fellow citizens descended on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, political commentators wondered aloud if we were witnessing the first moments of a civil war, whether we would look back on that afternoon as the time when the fabric of our American democracy began to unravel. Our guests today ask that fundamental question in their new book titled The Big Truth, Upholding Democracy in the Age of the Big Lie. The authors, CBS Chief Washington Correspondent Major Garrett and attorney David Becker, the executive director and founder of the nonpartisan nonprofit Center for Election Innovation and Research, say the question boils down to, will America reach its 300th birthday as a unified nation? Can the American experiment survive? The nation indeed seems impossibly polarized on a variety of issues, but as the authors point out in their introduction to the book, civil strife is not the same as civil war. The book, which historian Jay Winnick called doggedly researched, talks to the people on the front lines of American democracy. Poll workers, January 6th committee members Liz Cheney and Jamie Raskin, county clerks, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, and more. To expose the 2020 election conspiracy myths to scrutiny and explain how Trump and his supporters engaged in misdirection designed to undermine the election and democracy. Garrett and Becker explore whether the assault on the veracity of the 2020 election will have lasting consequences for democracy, a hypothesis that will likely be put to the test next month as Americans vote in the midterm elections. We're delighted to have both authors with us tonight. So please join me in welcoming Major Garrett and David Becker. So I have a very broad opening question, and you can riff on it as you like. And that is, why'd you decide to write this book? How would you say this book is different from the many books on the 2020 election that we've seen over the past year or so?
First of all, it's great to be with you. Thank you, John, for having us. It's always great to be at the National Press Club. Usually I'm in those seats, not up here, so it's a nice change for me. It's a great question. It is essentially the fundamental thing that David and I asked ourselves, why write this book? What are we trying to do? And the first thing I would say is it's not a Trump book, okay? It's a book about the 2020 election that is only marginally about the former president. It is principally about how Americans cast, and most importantly, how we count and verifiably and accurately count votes. And that's a broad area of focus, and we specify what happened unusually and successfully in 2020. The 2020 election is something that, broadly speaking, and on a bipartisan basis, even for people who don't have a party identification, just as Americans, we ought to regard as the accomplishment and achievement that it was. With the highest turnout of any presidential election in our country's history, with the most diverse electorate, we did that in the teeth of a global pandemic without any vaccines and with only mask wearing and social distancing mitigation strategies. We had to come up with all sorts of adaptations on the fly that we didn't know if they would work or how they would work. We moved precincts, we created voting centers, we adopted mail-in balloting, we did this massive education of voters who had very high interest in the election, but weren't sure how to adapt. We trained almost 400,000 new poll workers for the first time, almost all of them over Zoom, teaching them a procedure that is by its very nature both precise and physical. And we did that via Zoom. We did all the things that as a child growing up in this country, I regarded, my parents regarded, and the society I grew up in regarded as innately American. We were innovative. We didn't take no for an answer. We succeeded under difficult circumstances with a harsh deadline. We adapted without a roadmap. We did this amazing thing for our democracy broadly. And some 30 or 35% of our country believes a crime was committed. Not only is that absurd, factually, it debases this thing that we did as Americans for ourselves. And David and I just decided, no, we're not going to let that stand unanswered. And I'll let David pick it up.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's shocking how the dichotomy between the reality of the success of the 2020 election and the perception by those, many of whom were sincerely disappointed in the outcome, many of whom were good citizens who happened to have supported President Trump, and who have been exploited, whose disappointment has been exploited by the losing presidential candidate, to lead them to believe that our democracy is in dire straits when in fact it says secure, transparent, and verified as it's ever been. It's more professional than it's ever been. It's remarkable when you actually look at the facts of the 2020 election, how, as Major suggested, we achieved probably the greatest triumph of the American democratic process in history. We had more paper ballots than we've ever had before. We had more audits of those ballots than ever before. We had more pre-election litigation than we've ever had before, which meant that the rules were clarified before the election. Did both sides love all the rules? No, they did not. In fact, Republicans won 7 out of 8 court cases heading into the 2020 election before election night. But the rules were set. Both sides knew what those rules were. And then we had more post-election litigation ever that verified the result. The election that election officials put together, the professionals who run elections, and we are more professional in running elections than we've ever been, withstood this intense scrutiny. We've never seen that before. And it withstood it at every stage. We sit here now today, 708 days since the November 2020 election. And there has not been one shred of evidence presented to any court or to any law enforcement authority that would suggest that the outcome of the election was in doubt in any way. That's remarkable. And it's withstood that scrutiny. And during that time of that scrutiny, and this is one of the things that motivated Major and I quite a bit, was these election officials, these civil servants, these people who don't get famous or rich from their job. They do their job because it's a calling for them. They have been under intense abuse and harassment and threats during the entirety of those 708 days. And that continues now as we head into an election cycle where they're still preparing for probably record high turnout in a midterm election.
Well, I was going to ask you, my next question was going to be, were the, looking back on 2020, was it fair and valid and all that? And you gave an excellent summary of why it was not only fair, but heroic even, right? And of course, it's one thing to ask legitimate questions about election integrity and that sort of thing. But once they are adjudicated thoroughly by multiple, in fact, every single court, you got to say the story's over, right? However, and this is very discouraging for those of us in the news business, it doesn't seem to matter. The facts don't seem to matter.
Or they're recontextualized. Let me give you a very contemporaneous example. I was lucky enough to substitute for Margaret Brennan in moderating Face the Nation on Sunday. And Carrie Lake, the Republican nominee for governor, was on the show, as was Katie Hobbs, the Democratic nominee for governor. And I asked Carrie Lake, who won the primary in large part, or not in large part, but certainly in a non-insignificant part by baselessly saying the 2020 election was stolen in Arizona and nationwide, and Biden's an illegitimate president. Blake Masters, who won the Republican senatorial nominee, said the same thing in the primary, but then this week, or last week, backtracked. Said there's nothing about the election counting. It was about the FBI and Facebook and other things. And he was pressed on stage about the election counting and the results. No, I've got nothing there. So I asked Carrie Lake if she agreed. And instead of answering that question, she launched into a grand whataboutism. Well, Democrats complained about 2004. Democrats complained about 2016. Democrats complained about 2000. And no one called them election deniers, so I don't understand why you're picking on me. By the way, all of those objections are talked about in our book. We don't shy away from the fact that others who are not in the Republican Party have questioned the legitimacy of previous presidential elections. What we just say in a very direct way is the answer to small election denialism is not grotesque, violent election denialism.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a world where right now, and hopefully none of you are as into the weeds of election administration as someone like I am. That's my job. I do this all the time. But the fact is, our elections are as good as anywhere in the world at any time in the history of planet Earth. In the United States of America, we have extremely complex elections. One of the talking points of some of the election deniers was, oh, France counts all their ballots by hand in one night. Why can't the United States do it? Well, there's actually a really easy answer for that. In France, they vote on one race. They literally have different colored pieces of paper handed to each voter and an envelope, and they say, put that piece of paper in the envelope, and we will count that. Anyone who's voted in the United States knows your ballot probably has dozens of races. Depending upon your state, you might have dozens of pages. I'm a Californian. We are used to this. Major is as well.
Yep.
Dozens of pages on the ballot. We have so many races on the ballot. We are voting in so many elections. There's a saying in election administration, if it's Tuesday, there's an election somewhere. Doesn't matter when. And we somehow do that extremely well. And the best example of this is, think about Florida, for instance. Florida in 2000 was an international laughingstock. Legitimate issues about election administration, an incredibly close race, some election officials who appeared to be highly partisan. Think about Florida in 2020. We knew the outcome of Florida at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. They have so professionalized their work in a state where voters have the option of choosing to vote early in person, or by mail, or on election day, however they choose. And they had it, they got it right. They did such a good job. That's what's happened over the last 20 years. And instead of celebrating that, these people have found themselves under assault for 2 years.
Even in Florida.
Yeah, even in Florida. And by the way, even in California, even in Texas. Even
Utah.
It doesn't matter anymore what the actual outcome is, what the actual margin is. The election denial myth has taken on such a life of its own, and it has fueled so much grift, and by grift, I want to be very, very clear here. It has lined the pockets of those that have pervaded. That the incentive structure is so out of whack that this is going to continue to for some time unless we call it out. And thank God, and we talk about these people in the book, thank God for the people of courage, the truth tellers, often Republicans, who've been willing to uphold their oath of office, uphold their duty and their the principles of the United States Constitution, people like Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, people like Barbara Sagaski, the Secretary of State in Nevada, people like the members of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, people like Al Schmidt in Philadelphia, people like Liz Cheney, who have stood up for these.
People who, in a couple of cases, certified their election that they lost.
Yeah.
In the teeth of all this.
Yeah, we mentioned there's an election official from Michigan, a former election official, clerk from a town who ran for the county clerk in Michigan. Her name is Tina Barton. And she lost her race for county clerk in that county. And the chairwoman of the RNC came and spread some lies about the election. And she actually had a very famous viral video that she put out and said, no. This election was secure. Imagine being so principled and so tied to the values in the United States Constitution that you are willing to stand up publicly against the chairwoman of your own party and say an election that I lost was secure. Thank God for these people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we wrote the book in part to thank them and to have and to preserve in one place for all time what our original concept for this book was, which was a love letter to these people. Mm-hmm. But as events of 2021 and 2022 asserted themselves, it became a much larger, more ambitious meditation on the current state and possible future trajectory of this democratic experiment.
Right. So the elections have gotten stronger, the counting has gotten stronger, but the lie has gotten bigger, as you point out. And I just want to throw out, bear with me, because I got a couple statistics I want to throw out that I'm pretty sure have came out after the book was reported. Just this month, the Washington Post reported that 299 GOP candidates, federal and state elections, 53% denied outright or questioned the results of the 2020 elections. Others, including Brookings, have put the number even higher. In the House of Representatives, on January 6, 2021, there were 139 members who objected to one or more of the electors' slates. 139. Most of those are going to be reelected. Now there's 38 more election deniers who are not incumbents, but they're running for Congress, so there'll be new members. So it could be that the number is going to be close to 177 or so in this forthcoming House. That is getting in the neighborhood of 40% of the House, which is higher than the figure you just gave for the general population election deniers number, okay? Eight senators on January 6, 2021 voted to overturn the will of the voters. Now numerous Senate nominees, some of whom are gonna win, are also contesting it. In last statistic here, in the House, they recently voted on an update to the 1887 Electoral Count Act, and the Senate's gonna turn to that, and we can talk about that in a little more depth later. But in the House, only 9 Republicans voted in favor of updating that act to prevent manipulation of the election after the people have decided. So I just want to throw out those quite recent, some of them, statistics, and really ask the question, this is not a fringe phenomenon, is it? And is this now an entrenched element of the Republican Party?
It has certainly, within the context of Republican primaries, become something akin to a litmus test, that you have to be in this particular place, whether you believe it or not. Yeah. And I know some House Republicans who did not vote to certify knew that the election was valid. I'll get to a very specific way they knew it was valid in a moment, but they knew it was valid, but knew if they wanted to be reelected and avoid a primary challenge, yeah, they had to do it. They right. simply had to do it. They had no other choice. And I know in a couple of instances...
Well, they did have a choice, but to keep their jobs, they didn't have a choice.
I know in a couple of instances, these members went to their staffs and said, I don't want to do this. And the staff said, well, you can vote no, or you can certify, but you're done. Mm-hmm. And they chose to do the other thing against what they knew to be true in order to preserve their political viability. But the other way that they knew that this election was solid, I'm talking specifically now about Republicans in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Nevada, and Wisconsin. Those are the 6 states that everyone sort of talked about with some regularity. They all reported to Congress and swore their oath to take their position either as elected or reelected members, ironically validating the entire process, because that ballot wasn't a different ballot. As David said, there are complicated ballots with several questions. So don't tell me that by some magic intervention, and for a while that was kind of out there, there was a magic intervention which changed the vote totals for just one race. All these other members were sworn in. Same ballot. Same process, they are actually, though unwittingly, the leading verifiers of this 2020 election.
Yeah.
Hmm. It's just they don't get called on it with the frequency that I would prefer that they get called on it. Hmm. But they are actual verifiers of what we say the election of 2020 was, because they're in Congress. So are the state legislators who are changing voting laws because something was amiss. How do they have the power to do that? Because they got elected on that ballot. It's sort of darkly and not comedically ironic.
Yeah, I mean, this is a key point. The same paper ballots in Arizona, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, and in the other states that we've talked about elected every single member of Congress. The authority that they had to object to the electoral vote was granted by the same ballots that they were objecting to. For state legislators in Arizona, Wisconsin, and others who have conducted, you know, sham investigations of the election, they're essentially investigating their own election. They're essentially questioning their own authority that was conferred by voters. It's really remarkable that this has gone on as long as it has. The same paper, and by the way, all of these paper ballots in all of these states that we're talking about went through actual audits. I'm not talking about cyber ninjas in Arizona. I'm talking about a process that was set in advance of the election by legislatures and election officials to review a statistical sampling of the paper ballots, count them by hand, and compare them to the machine tabulations. That's what's done to make sure the machines are not malfunctioning for any reason. It's done routinely. It was done in virtually every state, including every battleground state, and those tabulations matched. Most famously, we will all remember, the presidential race was counted 3 times in the state of Georgia on paper ballots that they had for the first time in 2 decades. They did not have paper ballots prior to 2020. The last time they had paper ballots was the Bush versus Gore race of 2000. And those paper ballots were counted 3 times, 3 different ways, once entirely by hand. Over 5 million ballots counted entirely by hand, confirming the results. Mm-hmm. And yet, Congress people from the state of Georgia on those same ballots objected to the electoral count on January 6th.
Let me present a metaphor for just a second. I harken back to my childhood. It's a childhood metaphor that I think almost everyone in this room can identify with. My mother always told me to never pick a scab. Okay? Don't pick a scab. Don't pick a scab, right? Don't pick a scab. Why? Because it'll get worse. It'll get bigger and you'll get infected. Don't pick a scab. Okay. So if you remember back in this pre-January 6th time, the Republicans who were in the decertification or questioning certification, I'm just asking questions. Mm. I'm just asking questions, okay? I'm just asking questions. Fine. I don't accept that, but that's the sort of glazed over justification. All those questions, in any rational way, have been asked and answered. Not once, not twice, but repetitively. So let's just metaphorically say this: I'm asking questions is the scab. Well, you keep picking at it relentlessly over and over. That's what Republicans do. They keep going back to this. No, I'm not satisfied. It didn't happen. Something went wrong. We have to have integrity. We did have integrity. No, we have to have integrity. So they keep picking this scab of theirs over and over and over, making the wound bigger, making the infection spread more rapidly, becoming what we warn on our book will happen. If you treat denialism as a tactic, you will not get out of it. Denialism is like an infection. It creates for itself its own potency. You're not just playing with another tactical thing like, well, we'll say they're extremists on taxes or they're soft on crime. This is not like this. It is completely different. And my proof of that is exactly the statistics you just mentioned. It is more infectious now in this conversation than it was a year ago.
And if I could just add, the we're just asking questions. We didn't hear the same questions in 2016 from the same people. In 2016, we had fewer paper ballots. The entire state of Georgia had no paper ballots, except for a few mail ballots. The entire state of South Carolina had no paper ballots. Much of North Carolina, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, Philadelphia and Allegheny counties, did not have paper ballots in 2016. They could not be audited, they could not be recounted. We didn't have a paper record that the person had looked at, confirmed, and then cast. You didn't hear that in 2016. The margin in Pennsylvania was half the margin of 2020. It was 42,000 votes in 2016, won by President Trump, legitimately, by the way, and we say this, President Trump did win the presidency legitimately in 2016. Anyone who tells you otherwise is just as much of an election denier as anyone else. He won a majority of votes in states that comprised a majority of the Electoral College in 2016. You don't have to like it, that's a fact. He did not win the popular vote, as he said later. He was one of the only winning candidates I've ever heard to contend with an election that he actually won. But he did win that election. The margin in Pennsylvania in 2016, just over 40,000 votes. The margin in Pennsylvania in 2020, 84,000 votes. The margin in Michigan in 2016, about 10,000, 11,000, 12,000 votes. I don't remember the exact number. The margin in Michigan in 2020, 154,000 votes. Michigan wasn't close. It's one of the unusual things in this election. Michigan was not close remotely. And yet the questions weren't asked in 2016. We cannot get to the point as a society, and this stands for everyone across the political spectrum, where we only ask questions about the process after an election in which we've lost. That's a very dangerous point for a democracy. That's what we talk about a lot in the book. It applies to the left as much as it does to the right, which does not mean it's morally equivalent right now. It is not 50-50. It is just not 100-0. It's probably 99-1 or even higher than that. But it's still, there is some of it across the political spectrum, and we have to resist that effort to, after an election, criticize a process that we knew existed before the election because we didn't like the outcome. And a secure election be defined as only an election in which the candidate we preferred won.
Okay, I just want to remind everyone, I have plenty of questions, but if you guys have questions, put them on that card, give them to Kate, and she'll hand them up to me. So one thing I'm really intent on asking you about is this topic of disinformation, because you guys have done an amazing job in that book and on this stage of marshaling the facts and presenting them, which is an indispensable task, and thank you for it. But as I said a moment ago, you know, facts don't seem to matter, and at least they don't matter sufficiently, let's put it that way. And so my question is, how can we ever arrive at a big truth if Americans are working off divergent set of facts? What's the role of the media? What's the role of social media? I know that this wasn't the principal focus of your book, right, but I'm sure you have some thoughts.
So the simple answer to that is you write a book. Yeah. I mean, you do try to put it all in one place and hope that that becomes a resource available for people to refer to in one place all of the things that were true about the 2020 election. But there are other aspects of modern life that are reinforcing what's in the book. For example, Pennsylvania had a Republican Senate primary. David McCormick was about 1,000 votes behind Mehmet Oz. Under his rights, he asked for a recount. About a third of the way through the recount, he bailed out, said, it's not going to change. What does that tell you? A, that the process to count ballots in Pennsylvania materially exactly the same as it was in 2020 is resilient, replicable, and believable, and 1,000 votes isn't close. It just isn't. In recount terms, 1,000 votes is not close. And it was clear to David McCormick, about a third of the way through the recount, it wasn't going to move in any way that was materially going to change that outcome. So we bailed out, reinforcing the validity of everything we say in the book about that process. Arizona, I mentioned Carrie Lake a moment ago. She's a very interesting case study in this. Carrie Lake was running for the Republican nomination for governor, saying that the system is fraudulent, we should get rid of all the vote counting machines, and fraud was afoot before votes were even started to be counted. When she was trailing early, she said, there's fraud going on. Then something interesting happened. She went ahead. And as soon as she went ahead, she said, I'm the nominee. Well, how do you know that? I mean, how do you know you're the nominee? Well, we outvoted the fraud. Oh, okay, that's what happened. No, that's not what happened. The system that you rail against noxiously for political support is actually what verified what the voters chose. Now, the voters chose something, but you only embraced it and considered it for yourself personally valid when you went ahead. That's a compare and contrast in real time about these underlying questions. And when the deniers are the verifiers, it sort of illuminates all that we're talking about here. And it becomes a kind of hitch in their giddy-up. And I believe, and David and I believe, these facts will never, ever change. They won't. They're immovable. They are not intimidated. They won't be intimidated. And we believe, and I believe my entire career is based on the idea that facts matter and will endure. And I'll stand on that as long as I can.
Yeah, and John, I think your question really highlights the asymmetrical warfare that's going on here. From the perspective of election officials, those who are trying to preserve and protect democracy, they're protecting, you know, almost imagine a citadel where they're protecting it from 360 degrees, and they have to protect every aspect of that citadel. They have to, we've never had a perfect election in this country, but an election is an incredibly complex endeavor. The 2020 election, we had 160 million Americans doing something they weren't particularly familiar with in the middle of a global pandemic in a process run by 10,000 jurisdictions, hundreds of thousands of professional election workers, and a million volunteers. It's a freaking miracle. Every major election is a miracle. And they pull it off every time. And they have to get everything right. It's not perfect, but they have to get everything right. The election deniers just have to pierce that citadel at one point. We have a chapter in the book called Misdirection where you can see the constantly shifting explanations for why the election was stolen. It doesn't matter that none of them are consistent with each other or even with reality. They're going to keep pushing those things because they just have to find one little point they can pierce. And so where there are legitimate challenges, there were some things that were not perfect. If you look at, if you're familiar with Antrim County, Michigan, where the initial count was wrong because of and when I say initial, I mean in the day after the election it was wrong. It was discovered right away. It was a software glitch. They fixed it, and they documented that it was accurate by actually going back to the paper ballots and counting them. That's a normal thing that happens in elections. It's why the election night results that we all hear and we're all like desperate for, right? We want to know who won the election at 8:01 p.m. Please tell us that right away. By the way, you're going to know nothing at 8:01 p.m. on November 8th. Be ready for that. You might not know anything on November 18th.
You know, okay? A few things by November 18th.
Well, maybe, but not much. Just be prepared for that. But those are all unofficial. There's a reason that every state waits to have certified results, official results, until days or weeks after, and that is because they are checking and double-checking every single thing. That's the way the process works. It works well. But election officials have this almost impossible job that they get right every time of defending every degree of that 360-degree structure, and the election deniers just have to find that one particular point where they can pierce it with some claim of bamboo ballots or a dead Venezuelan dictator.
Thanks. So, as a journalist, I believe facts matter. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in this business. But unfortunately, they matter less and less to fewer people.
No,
and you guys know that. So I can't imagine that we are ever going to get out of this hall of mirrors unless we figure out a way to improve, not solve, not make 100% better, but improve the social media, the ideological news organizations. I mean, we got to do better at that. So that's the reason I threw that out there.
And that part is not in the book because we really did try to stay on the task.
Right.
The task was this election, the 2020 election. The other task was what laws have changed since the 2020 election, which ones expand access, and some states have expanded access. It's not only one dimension story post-2020. Some states have restricted it. We go into that. But we really had this task, and You're right. You're not wrong about those things. But we made a conscious decision that if we wade into that terrain, A, we can't solve it, and B, we would lose focus of the crux of our mission.
Understood. But anything to comment on it now?
Well, in the sense that I often joke.
No, it's a big topic.
I often joke that we call the book The Big Truth. And I say, it's not a religious book. That would be the biggest truth, you know. But the title wouldn't exist if there wasn't something we are in opposition to, which is the big lie. And the big lie exists now at almost a quasi-religious entity. And through social media and the velocity and the reach of it, we have reached a point, at least on this topic, where we're sort of going before the Enlightenment to the Dark Ages, when belief structures were the true structures. I believe it, therefore it's true. Yeah. The Enlightenment taught us, no, there are things that you can discern through facts and research and then reveal truth. The Dark Ages were, I believe it, therefore it's true. And that's sort of where denialism is. I believe it, therefore it's true. And I don't, now that I believe it, all this other pushing by gentlemen like David and I is like, well, that just sort of gets in the way of things. My belief structure is really what matters, and it's very close to my identity. And my identity is wrapped up in this belief structure. So if you're challenging me in my belief structure, you're challenging me as a person and my identity. And that becomes very volatile political terrain.
That's a great answer.
And I'll just add briefly, I mean, there is a, there's a human tendency to seek validation. I mean, it's a very natural human tendency. I often say technology doesn't change human behavior, it facilitates human behavior. It's a natural human behavior to seek that out. We call for, in this book, for an active citizenship. And an active citizenship is actually based in some ways on humility. I mean, it's based on a sense that we shouldn't be seeking validation constantly from our media sources in particular. One of the things that struck me after the 2016 election, I don't know many people who weren't surprised at the outcome of the 2016 election, whether they were happy with it or not happy with it. I was surprised with it, and I do this for a living. And I decided I'm not getting an input of information that's really educating me, that's challenging me, that's forcing me to confront maybe some difficult perspectives. And I sought out more perspectives that were different than that. I will be the first to admit that was something that I was pushed towards. But we all need to confront these aspects of our own media appetites and look for things that challenge us and force us out of our comfort zones. And again, one of the things we talk about in the book a great deal is that we are not critical of the tens of millions of people who voted for President Trump. There are people who had legitimate policy disagreements with now President Biden, who preferred President Trump for a variety of reasons that other people can disagree with, but that's legitimate. What's wrong is to delegitimize a process, the elections process, where the facts are, as Major suggested, very, very clear, and to then justify the idea that your candidate couldn't have actually possibly lost, when in actuality, the 2020 election was had the widest margin of any presidential election in the 21st century when President Obama wasn't on the ballot. 7 million votes in the popular vote, 3 states at a minimum that defined the Electoral College. That is something we haven't seen in the 21st century when Barack Obama wasn't on the ballot.
That's another great answer. Thank you both. So I want to grab a question from the audience. There are illiberal democracies around the world where political opponents see each other as enemies. When they win, they feel justified in claiming absolute power. Are we moving toward a liberal democracy in the United States? And I would tack on, talk about the question of civil war that you raise in the book.
So we do fear that there is something happening in our politics that makes political disagreements feel much more primal and much more existential, and that disagreements are getting this colorization of enemy, that in our rhetoric and in our even official actions taken by states, there's a process of separation, boycotting, and it's manifested itself in disagreements among states about abortion, about migration, and what to do with those who have sought to come to this country. It's playing itself out with the governors of Arizona, Texas, and now Florida, moving migrants to other states to drop them in because those states are so different from ours. That's a process that's already playing out, and it creates this idea that of separateness, that we're unrecognizable to each other. And when you're unrecognizable to each other, the idea is the what Abraham Lincoln called the mystic bonds of union, they become a complete mystery. They dissolve. And we write in the first chapter a process by which a disagreement over the 2020 midterm elections leads to that very dissolution of the union. A civil war that doesn't have bullets and bayonets, has rhetoric, procedure, and a gradual separation, an alienation of like-minded states from other states that are like-minded in opposition to these like-minded states. And I won't give it all away, but it's not impossible. I mean, not only is it not possible, we believe, and many people who we've asked to take a look at this chapter said, my God, it's so believable, it's borderline terrifying.
I agree.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not a prediction.
We workshop right. this with friends and colleagues to kind of say, are we out of our minds here? And to a person, they were like, oh no, this could happen. And I think one of the other things, in addition to civil war, whether it's a violent conflict or if it's something that is more of a civil cold war, and I was just thinking about this today, is almost as frightening as the idea that we might start dissolving the union and not care enough to have a civil war.
Yeah.
I mean,
Sort of do it by indifference whateverism.
Do California, Illinois, and Massachusetts want to be in the same union as Florida and Texas?
They talk like maybe they don't. I don't know. Yeah, it seems like an open question.
I mean, this is a question we raise, we contemplate. I mean, the 250th anniversary of America is coming up in mm-hmm. 4 years.
Yeah.
We've been through a lot as a country, and we are seeing right now, I don't know if it's unique, but it certainly seems heightened right now, and certainly in the area of social media, as you mentioned, John, we seem to view each other as enemies. We seem to view people with whom we have policy disagreements as mortal enemies. This is something that autocrats around the world for the past century have tried to inflict on the United States, have tried to encourage us to do, and they've been unsuccessful. And we're doing it to ourselves. And let's be honest, Beijing, Moscow, Pyongyang, Tehran, they're applauding. They're sitting back and laughing as we're doing this to ourselves.
Without doubt.
Well, it's good that you mentioned other countries. Well, let me first say, I think you're performing an incredibly important service by posing the difficult question about civil war. You also point out in the book, we don't want to get to the point where people feel that's inevitable, because then you're really in trouble. But we absolutely have to confront that question. So you mentioned other countries. Is there any other country, this questioner asks, that has lessons we in the USA can learn from on some of these issues?
David, I'll let you go to that.
Of course you do. So what we've seen over the course of the past, probably a little bit less than a decade, is we have seen a lot of efforts to amplify domestic discord by autocracies, not just in the United States, but in other countries. I mean, Israel is likely to have its fourth election in about 2 years. Germany has seen this. France has seen this. Italy has seen this. Throughout many of the established world democracies, I think we're all still figuring this out. By the way, Brazil is literally dealing with this as we speak. We have the sitting head of the Brazilian government who is in charge of Brazil's election system with the election commission there, criticizing that election system over which he has overseen for the past several years. Why? Because he's losing. That's the only reason. So these attacks are ongoing. I think you know, I think there have been some small successes in places like France, in places like Germany, in places like Canada. I think actually we need to recognize the success that 2020 was here in the United States. And this is one of the key points of our book. I mean, this was a remarkable moment. I want to put this in perspective. We had never seen more than 139 million voters in the United States of America ever. Not close. We had 160 million in 2020. More than 20 million more people showed up in the middle of a global pandemic where we didn't have all the information about how COVID was spread. Pre-vaccine, as Major had mentioned, where election officials were getting sick because you can't plan elections in socially distant. You have to be together in an office. We did that. 20 million more Americans showed up. 67% of all eligible Americans. The last time that happened was Reconstruction. And the reason we hit 67% was not because the numerator was large, it was because the denominator was small. It's because many women couldn't vote, many African Americans couldn't vote. We did that in 2020. And let's celebrate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have another election coming up in a few weeks here, the midterm elections. So what will you all be watching for? And in particular, in the book, you talked about the upcoming election as a test for democracy. So what did you mean by that?
Well, for example, here's some good news. 11 states are already voting. Right now. It's happening. It's all good. It's happening. Process is playing out. People are voting in some states early in person. They found out where to go, filling out the ballots. It's happening. Making the choice to vote on the information they have now. Well, they should vote on the same day. No, if people choose to vote on a different day with the information they have, they've already made, fine. It's happening. It's playing out. Good. One of the things we're going to be watching for is how redistricting will change, because you change district lines, you change precincts, sometimes you change, or in who you're voting for, whose voters have to adapt to that. That's new information. Many states have changed their laws. Not all of them, as I said before, have been restrictive. Some have been restrictive. In a place like Texas, we're going to be watching very closely. Texas was a tough place to vote before the law changes. After the 2020 election, it's a tougher place to vote now. Those difficulties tripped up a lot of experienced primary voters in March. And by definition, if you're a primary voter, you're an experienced voter. A lot of people sit out primary votes, just show up for the general. So a lot of Texas voters are going to have to deal with this new process. How will that work? How will they be tripped up? Was there enough voter education going on? The election results, I think we can be pretty confident, are going to be close in a lot of places. They're going to be close in Arizona in all likelihood. They're going to be very close in Georgia in all likelihood. Could be very close in Wisconsin. Might be close in Pennsylvania. We have to prepare, and this is an obligation I think the media did very well on in 2020. It's going to have to redo the lessons and the voter education in 2022. As David said, prepare voters to assume, just to assume, elections will be close, to get the results tabulated properly and verified so there are no glitches. You're going to have to wait. And that patience is something that is going to test us. Because unlike 2020, when denialism was in its infancy, if you will, it's much more malevolently mature now. And the idea that something is wrong can be injected into this space of uncertainty, which is not about problems. It's about actual rule-based procedure. We're going to have to be on guard for that. Now, the good news side of that is police departments and sheriffs now know that threats to election officials and harassment is real. They were slow to that in 2020. They weren't accustomed to it. They weren't prepared for it at all. They know about it now. And I think they're going to be on guard, and they're not going to accept harassment and negative behavior and volatility that is meant to interfere and create confusion. I certainly hope that's true. I have every rational belief that it will be true.
Yeah, I just want to build on a point that Major made and I made earlier. Election day for media and media consumers is incredibly challenging. It is when demand for news is at its peak and the supply of news is zero. Think about that for a second. I mean, it is, it's the worst case scenario. And all of us as media consumers, I do this for a living. I wanna know who won at 8:01 p.m. I mean, it's natural, it's okay to wanna know. But be evangelists for this. Go out and talk to your friends and your families and everyone else. Expect to know nothing. The close races are going to be close. There is a process where they have to go and count the ballots and double check the counts of ballots. They're going to take some time to do this. That means the process is working. It doesn't mean there's a problem with that. Also take into account the fact that both the control of the House and the Senate are going to be very close. They might come down to a handful of races around the country, including, and hear me out on this, California, where they have 52 new congressional districts, and control of the House might come down to this. People don't realize this. California takes longer to count ballots than anyone else in the country. Why don't we know about this? Because the statewide elections have such a huge margin. But in the congressional races, those margins will not be that big. And we might be waiting until Thanksgiving for some of those California congressional races.
To be certified.
And that means the process is working. That's okay. The problem is there are going to be people who perceive themselves to be losing, who may have already espoused election denialist philosophy, who may use that opportunity and that uncertainty to incite violence. We talk about this a great deal in the book. I'm not that worried that losers of the elections are going to be anointed as the winners. That's really hard to do. The losing the candidate who won is not going to just roll over and allow that to happen. They're going to go to courts. The courts have held, let's be honest about this, in 2020 and after that. But in that period of uncertainty, when 48% of the electorate is being led to believe that an election is being stolen, what might they do? If you believe an election is stolen, what behavior might you be willing to justify? This is not a hypothetical. This is January 6th. Now imagine this happens in dozens of places at dozens of times. We got to find a more optimistic way to end this. Sorry, that's one of the things we talk about. And there
hopefully
is an optimistic part of the book, I promise you.
I hate to admit this, but I said to friends and neighbors after January 6th, if I believed what those rioters believed, I might have been there with them, right? Mm-hmm. I hope I wouldn't have, but believe me, the thought would have crossed my mind, because what they believed was that our democracy had been endangered, right? Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. It occurs to me that because I think facts matter still to some extent, and they can have a positive effect. The story that you have told here so well about the success of the 2020 elections, it's not really a news story now, it's more of a history thing. So do you think that the news media can do and social media, maybe companies like Meta, can do more to inoculate, you know, the citizenry ahead of these midterm elections to tell the story that you've told about, hey, this was not only done right, this was done heroically right.
I don't know. I can tell you that story is not going to get on the CBS Evening News.
Yeah.
When we cover the January 6th hearings, I've been a part of almost all of our coverage of that. I make sure to make that point fundamentally clear.
Right.
The witnesses, all of whom work for President Trump in one capacity or another, campaign, lawyers, outsiders, pollsters, all called by the committee, have all said, yeah, he lost. Trump employees on the payroll all said, yeah, he lost. And I told him he lost to his face. White House counsel's office, you know. And so that's been part of this conversation. I don't know enough about the social media companies and platforms and their business modeling or their inclinations to know whether or not they would even take this on as a task.
Fair enough.
But one thing I will say, because it's really important, what you said about the idea that what would you do if you fundamentally believed the election was stolen? So in the back third of the book, we talk about some of the consequences. And I spent a lot of time, as we prepared to write that chapter, looking through letters written to the court by people who were in the docket for attacking the Capitol on January 6th.
It's a very powerful part of the book.
And I spent a lot of time reading those letters because they broke my heart. They literally broke my heart. People wrote to court and said, I believed my president. I thought something terrible was happening. And I was motivated to protect my country. And my president lied to me. I never imagined a situation. I'm not quoting directly. This is very close to what they wrote.
Very close.
And I never thought my president would lie to me. And I'm now so sorry for the police, for the staff, for all the people who were scared. This part is almost a direct quote. I would do anything to take it back. I would do anything to have my life back. Those are profound testimonials from our fellow citizens. My heart goes out to them. And don't tell me, oh, they were just making that up to get a light sentence. In many cases, they didn't get a light sentence. They got what the requirements called for. And they, I will also say, in every single letter, at one point or another, they say, I will accept whatever consequences come to me. I'm not asking to be let off the hook. But I want the record to reflect where I was and where I've come to. They're heartbreaking letters to read. They really, really are. And of all the things that I find lamentable and tragic about this topic that we take on, it's that. It's that.
I mean, as we're sitting here now, one of the defendants is preparing a public authority defense in his trial. Scott McFarland of CBS has reported well on this. Basically what that defense says, what I was doing, I was ordered to do by the President of the United States. So this is the flip side of that. Someone who has less remorse for his actions trying to establish a defense that he was ordered to do it by the President of the United States. It is heartbreaking. You have to wonder, and for many of us, there are people who supported Trump, who opposed Trump. There's some people who opposed Trump in 2016 and voted for him in 2020, but probably that Venn diagram is pretty small overlap. In 2016 that didn't happen. We have a chapter in the book where we hypothesize what might have happened had Secretary Clinton decided to challenge the results of the election as Donald Trump did and tried to use the authority of the federal government under President Obama to do it. I think that's important because it's important for both Republicans and Democrats to look through the lens at kind of somewhat differently. I want to make one more point about the media, though, John. I think it's a really important one. And I can say this as not a member of the media, although I do work with CBS occasionally. The media did a remarkably good job in 2020, the best job it's ever done. Major talks a lot about it. Major was one of the leaders on this. When I first came onto CBS talking about the process, he really enmeshed himself in the process and understanding. And by the way, for those of you who don't work in elections, it is incredibly esoteric. It will bore you to death. It is designed to be boring. It is rote. It is duplicative. It is redundant. It is transparent with multiple observers. It's designed to be that way. It's really good in that sense. But think back to pre-November 2020, when the media did such a good job of educating all of us on the red mirage, blue wave effect. That's a really good example. That was a fairly new effect. Mail ballots, by the way, I think as many of you in the audience might know, mail ballots prior to 2020 tended to be slightly Republican. Why? Who votes by mail? Property owners, older people, tend to vote Republican. So this is why states like Utah and Arizona and Republican election officials in Washington State had established mail voting. For the first time ever, mail voting was somewhat different, and because mail ballots were going to be counted later in some places, and because the Republican candidate had so delegitimized mail ballots, we knew that was going to lead to the red mirage, blue wave effect, and that was told well by the media in advance.
Yes.
So I think there's a really good example of the media doing a really good service to our nation in that sense. I think that's getting better even over time. You've talked about this before, you might want to elaborate, but how democracy desks are now being established in so many news organizations. So I want to give credit to the media because I think they've learned a lot. It's not just about the horse race anymore.
Yeah. There may be one or two channels that don't deserve your praise. But we won't mention those. Before we conclude this evening's discussion, I want to thank Headliners co-team leaders Donna Linewan-Legere and Lori Russo, also the Headliners team member who organized today's event, Elisa Free, and Club Communications Director Kate Helster, and Club Executive Director Bill McCarron. And of course, thanks to Major Garrett and David Becker for an extraordinary event. And I want to present you with the coveted National Press Club mug.
There we go. David, I'll give that to
souvenir.
You. There we go. See, there we go.
How many of these do you have?
You can never have enough.
Never have enough. Never right. have enough. Thank you.
Okay, so one last question, yep. and then we're going to wrap it up. I hope we can leave on a semi-positive note here, and that is, what can a patriotic American do to strengthen democracy? What can an individual do about this situation?
Two things. And if you read the acknowledgments of the book, and I might get a little catch in my throat here. I grew up in San Diego, California. My mother was an executive with AT&T, Ma Bell, as it was called back then, the monopoly. My father also worked for AT&T, but I was lucky enough, deeply lucky enough, in the 60s and 70s to have two parents who left work every day carrying briefcases. Looking up to a mother who was an executive was unusual in that time, and it's benefited me my entire life. The reason I bring up my mother is that in addition to doing that work, she was a poll worker. Every election, she walked up the hill to a garage, which was our neighborhood precinct, and was a poll worker. And she explained that to me as not only her civic duty and her participation in our country, it's how she kept track of the neighborhood. Because she was busy at work all the time. She couldn't do all the other things, but that's how she kept up with her neighbors. Everyone who got married, a new baby, whatever. In 2020, my eldest daughter, my mother passed away in 2014, in honor of her grandmother, was a poll worker for the first time.
That's great.
So I believe in the generational tendency of Americans to participate, not only as voters, but as workers. That's one thing you can do. Be part of this process. Be part of your neighborhood decentralized, localized, small m miracle that our democracy is. The other thing is, and this goes much more broadly to David's observation about media silos and being outwardly ratified. I would ask in a general way that when you think about American politics, think more about the quality of your participation than your level of satisfaction or dissatisfaction. And if we change that axis just a little bit to the participatory side, we'll all be a little better off.
I gotta follow that. So I've been in elections for over a quarter of a century. I'm a lawyer. I was working for a law firm in Los Angeles when I decided to apply for my dream job, which I knew I wouldn't get, which was to be a voting section attorney in the Department of Justice. I thought, how great is it that this country hires good lawyers to represent the most disenfranchised members of our society? What other country does that? And our country does. And I was fortunate enough to get that job. I've been here in DC ever since. I was in Selma, Alabama, observing the election when the first African-American mayor of Selma was elected in 2000. This is a city that is two-thirds black. He defeated the mayor, Joseph Smitherman, who was the mayor of Alabama in 2000 and had been the mayor of Selma, Alabama, rather, since Bloody Sunday in 1965.
Wow.
I've been very fortunate to work in the space, and as a lawyer for the Department of Justice, one of the things I often did is I'd walk into election officials' offices and carry with me the implicit threat of suing them, because that's what the DOJ does. And over time, what I realized was these people are not potential defendants. They're not potential violators of the law. They are people who do this because it's a calling. They sometimes have trouble complying with the law. They try to figure it out. They are under-resourced. They are under stress. And they just wanted help. If you ask any election official in any of the places where you happen to live, if you know any of your election officials, ask them how they got into election administration. I'll guarantee you, it was by accident. They didn't go to college and major in election administration. That's not a thing. There was no young election officials club at their high school. That's not what happened. They applied for a job, and they got into that job, and they found a calling that keeps them in that job. We talk a lot about the election officials who are leaving, and there are many election officials who have had enough and are leaving. Think about all the ones that are staying. Think about all the ones that are being pressured every day by election deniers and grifters to violate their oaths, and yet we can count the number who actually did that in the 10,000 election jurisdictions around the country on one hand. How amazing is it that we have this civil service in our country, people who are far-right Republicans, far-left Democrats, and everything in between, and their sacred duty is to make sure the voice of the voters is heard, and they will stand up for that duty regardless of whether their candidate wins or loses. This is what the backbone of democracy is in our country, and we don't recognize it enough because most of us only go to vote every now and then, and we don't really think about the people there. It is amazing that we accomplish this. No other country runs decentralized elections like we do. No other country runs complex elections that we do. No other country has to withstand the media and legal scrutiny that we do every time. And we manage it. It's a miracle.
And getting back to your first question, that's why we wrote the book.
Wow, two great final answers to a fantastic event. And thank you, Major.
Thank you so much,
David.
Thank you so very, very much.
And really, we are adjourned.
Really, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.